From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. German officials have launched a manhunt across Europe. They're looking for a Tunisian national with ties to Islamic extremists. Investigators believe he is linked to this week's attack at a Christmas market in Berlin. Several news organizations report that his identification papers were found inside the truck that was used in the attack. 12 people were killed, 48 injured, and 12 of the wounded are still hospitalized with serious injuries. Police in Berlin say they received over 500 tips after Monday's attack. Now, the Tunisian suspect had sought asylum in Germany. So let's get more on the latest on the Berlin attack. We're joined by Damian McGuinness. He's BBC's Berlin correspondent. And Damian, first, what do we know so far about this new suspect that authorities are looking for?
German authorities, Meghna, have now confirmed that they are looking for a man from Tunisia who is in his early 20s. And they say that he came to Germany in July 2015. And that's when he requested asylum here. He then had that application for asylum rejected the following summer in June 2016. And usually in Germany, the idea is that you should then be deported back to your origin country. That did not happen. It wasn't possible because Tunisia denied that he was a Tunisian citizen. And that meant that he stayed on in Germany. He moved around the country and went from state to state, ending up in Berlin. And the authorities have said that they have been aware of this man for a while and that he had close connections to jihadi networks in Germany. Because, of course, the problem here in Germany is that there are hundreds and hundreds of potentially dangerous Islamist extremists who are known to the police, who they are monitoring. And this was one of them, it seems. And now, obviously, questions are going to be asked about why he wasn't, if the police were aware of him, why he wasn't monitored more closely.
Or even detained if he had been scheduled for deportation, right?
The issue is that it's illegal to deport someone if the origin country won't take them in. So what this has meant is if, for example, an asylum seeker who's had their application for asylum is rejected and they don't have ID documents, you can't deport them. If the country they're coming from is a war zone, such as Syria, you can't deport them. You also can't deport them if there's no guarantee, if you can't prove that they're actually from the country you think they're from. So in this case, Tunisia denied that he was a Tunisian national. That now has the officials have just revealed that actually they've now got the official confirmation from Tunisia, ironically enough, just this morning. So there are all sorts of legal problems, and that's going to be the next big issue. That's going to be the big political debate in Germany right now after this attack, because there are large numbers of people who have been whose application for asylum have been rejected. And now the calls are going to grow to think, how can you solve that? Because in most cases, they're obviously not dangerous terrorists. But in this case, it was the fact that it was someone who was dangerous and, in theory, at least, should not have been in Germany in the first place.
Wow. So an ongoing intense investigation and manhunt. All of this is of a very sensitive nature right now. But Damian, you raised some critical questions about, you know, what this means for Germany's policy about asylum seekers who've been rejected moving forward. Because given that, I'm seeing that it was just yesterday that German Chancellor Angela Merkel, in speaking about this horrible attack, said that it would be especially difficult if it turned out that the person who did the attack was someone who had sought asylum in Germany. Now, again, this person is a suspect now. We don't have confirmation that he actually did it. But nevertheless, how are people responding to Merkel today?
Well, it's interesting, actually, Meghna, because on the one hand, it was interesting that Mrs. Merkel said those comments. When she said those comments, there was another suspect in the frame who was also an asylum seeker. That turned out to be a false lead. That's why we have to be very careful, obviously, with all these, some of them unconfirmed details. But the mood in Germany is interesting because you do have many of Mrs. Merkel's critics, particularly in the populist far-right AfD party, a new anti-migrant party. They've criticised Mrs. Merkel even more heavily after this attack. But I have to say, within the public debate, that has backfired because that is seen as trying to win political capital off the back of this tragedy. And people don't like that at all here. What I feel I've noticed over the last 24 hours is that those people who don't like Mrs. Merkel's policy anyway are criticising her even more heavily because of this attack. But it's not persuading anyone who backed her in the first place that it was a bad thing to do, because the country is split on this. And the mainstream majority opinion stands behind the idea that Germany has a duty to take in legitimate refugees. Now, there are lots of questions about who's legitimate and how, what you should do with those whose application has been rejected, such as this particular man. But the basic principle that Germany takes in refugees fleeing war and conflict is actually not that controversial here. And all mainstream parties sign up to it and mainstream society agrees with it. You have a minority in the far right or in populist right wing parties, but they are a minority. That is not the majority opinion here in Germany, it has to be said. It's very different to the mood in the States and in Britain, actually.
Well, Damian McGuinness is the BBC's Berlin correspondent. Damian, thank you so very much.
Pleasure. Thank you, Meghna.
Well, President-elect Donald Trump appears to have fossil fuels on his mind as he nominates his cabinet picks. Former governor of oil-rich Texas Rick Perry at the Energy Department, ExxonMobil CEO Rex Tillerson to run state, and fracking-friendly Oklahoma Attorney General Scott Pruitt to lead the EPA. So where do renewables like solar energy fit in the new Republican agenda? Well, in places like Arizona, as Will Stone of Here and Now contributor KJZZ in Phoenix reports.
Take a walk around Charlie Miller's neighborhood, and it quickly becomes a sales pitch.
Mine's had it for 5.5 years. This one's had it for 5 years.
He's talking about solar panels.
That one is brand new. Down the street, there's about 4 more.
And that's just one block in Pebble Creek, a retirement community west of Phoenix with more than 4,000 homes, 25% of them with rooftop solar.
You do one solar house. He plays golf with his friend. His friend's all upset. He got a $450 bill, and he says, oh, geez, mine's 30. It's contagious.
Miller moved to Arizona just as rooftop solar was taking off. Now he works for a local installer. Plenty of homeowners and sunshine, plus high summer bills, all explain why solar makes so much sense in Pebble Creek, a solidly Republican area.
When you go into these houses, you don't need to talk anybody into solar. And we have as many conservatives in here or more. They ready for solar?
In fact, Miller goes to local Republican clubs spreading the doctrine of solar, a doctrine shared by some prominent Republicans here.
Conservatives should be on top of this because of freedom of choice.
That's former Congressman Barry Goldwater Jr.
Choice in education, choice in health care. This is just another choice of where you get your energy from.
Goldwater chairs an advocacy group called Tell Utilities Solar Won't Be Killed. He says Republicans haven't done enough for solar in Arizona. The utilities wield a lot of influence, he says, and are not a fan of competition.
And that's what renewable energy is to a utility, because utility has a business plan that is basically a dinosaur. They're not open for new ideas.
Of course, utilities don't see it that way. Rooftop solar reduces customers' reliance on the grid. That lowers bills. So does net metering, which reimburses solar customers for the electricity they send into the grid. Arizona's largest utility, APS, wants to pay solar customers less for that energy, claiming this subsidy shifts costs onto its other customers. And that subsidy makes solar socially and economically unjust, says Paul Walker with Conserve America, a conservative conservation group.
As the wealthy homes move off of the system, they're leaving more and more of the fixed costs for the people that couldn't afford to get solar in the first place.
Walker says utilities recognize that and are trying to correct the problem, not kill clean energy.
We see that in a lot of the PR, where there's talk about a war on solar or taxing the sun. And I just haven't ever seen anything that really shows Arizona utilities are opposed to solar.
Walker points to a new state program that he dubs Blue Collar Solar. Instead of customers investing in a big solar system, the utility owns the panels and pays a fixed monthly rate for the roof space.
The common reason why for going solar is really economics.
James Tong is with a California-based group called Advanced Grid Consulting. He spoke via Skype.
It's not necessarily the tree hugger that actually goes solar.
Tong has studied the demographics of solar customers and says political persuasion isn't always a good indicator of who buys in.
They both see solar as a means to freedom from monopoly, but the conservatives see it as a more of a way to protect their individual freedom, whereas the liberal may see it as, well, we're protecting the environment, which is more of a collective freedom.
And attitudes seem to be changing. Polling shows more Republicans are worried about climate change in recent years. And 75% of Trump voters would like to increase renewable energy. Here's Conserve America's Paul Walker again.
That doesn't fit with what most people think is true about conservatives or about Trump supporters. But we're seeing that more and more and more.
And most experts say even under a Trump administration, the market for renewables will continue to grow because costs have come down so much. And you have conservative enthusiasts like Charlie Miller back in Pebble Creek.
It's a good investment, but it's also good for the earth. I mean, we're making energy here with no emissions.
Miller and other Republicans on the ground in red, sunny states like Arizona will be making their case for more energy choices. For Here and Now, I'm Will Stone in Phoenix.
It's hard to think of Johnny Cash without thinking of his music. Our next guest calls it the boom chicka boom chicka boom rhythm that carries the lyrics.
Hey, get a rhythm. When you get the blues, come on, get a rhythm. When you get the blues, get a rock and roll feeling in your bones, put taps on your toes and get gone, get a rhythm. When you get the blues.
But Johnny Cash's lyrics are poetic by themselves, and it turns out he also wrote poetry throughout his long life, in which he wrestled with the same themes of love, loss, and faith. These poems were scratched on scraps of paper or written in journals or tucked in books he loved. His son says those included the ancient texts of Flavius Josephus, Gibbon's History of the Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, and, of course, Johnny Cash's Bible. And now they've been collected in a new book. It's called Johnny Cash, Forever Words, The Unknown Poems. It was put together by Johnny's son, John Carter Cash, and edited by Paul Muldoon, the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet. And Paul Muldoon joins us from the NPR studios in New York. Paul, you write that you and others worried about letting these poems, you know, out of the attic and into the world, if maybe Cash wouldn't want it, if it would do him a disservice.
Well, I think that is a real concern. I mean, one does not want to sully, let's use a word like that, the memory, the reputation of Johnny Cash, which is, pretty much unassailable. So we didn't want to be printing anything that we thought wasn't up to par.
Well, but you write, it was with an initial sense of relief, then an increasingly rapturous glee that I realized there is much here that will indeed broaden and deepen our perception of Johnny Cash and his legacy. So pick one you want to start off with.
Well, let me start with one called California Poem, which I think is very evidently a poem. And I think it's not just because it's short. There's trouble on the mountain, and the valley is full of smoke. There's crying on the mountain, and again the same heart broke. The lights are on past midnight, the curtains closed all day. There's trouble on the mountain, the valley people say.
That, 1966.
Yeah, and there's something about that. I mean, it's not that it couldn't function as a song lyric. It absolutely could. But there's something in the nuance of the valley, people say. You know, it's almost as if it forces us to put the stress on the valley people. And one of the things that we simply cannot do, or at least it's very difficult to do, it, when we're singing a song, is to stress one word over another. It's just one of those. It's one of those distinctions that actually is a clue as to how these two genres might indeed be different.
Well. What I love about that you picked out is that I immediately had an image. I saw the dark mountain. I saw people in the valley looking up at the house with the curtains closed all day and furtive glances worrying about it. I mean, it paints an incredible picture. And we know that much of Johnny Cash's work springs from the poverty of the Great Depression. He grew up in Arkansas. I mean, do you feel that? You've compared the work to Scottish.
Well, I have, and I hope that's not an idle comparison. You know, the great American song tradition stems substantially from the great song traditions of Ireland, England, and Scotland.
Sure.
And indeed, the Cash family come from Scotland, and indeed they're mentioned as being associated with Dunfermline Town. And of course, it was Dunfermline Town where the fabulous ballad Sir Patrick Spens is set. The king sits in Dunfermline Town. And one of the things I really love about Johnny Cash is the extent to which he's able to extend the ballad tradition. And there's one that I think is particularly representative of that. It's called The Dogs Are in the Woods. Mm. The dogs are in the woods, and the hunting's looking good, and the raccoons on the hill, I can hear them trailing still. But he's on the other side, and he'll find a place to hide, but the dogs will hunt him down, and they'll catch him on the ground. Mm. But the fur is going to fly, and a hound is going to cry, and we may not know tonight who will finally win the fight. And, you know, that's an absolutely astonishing stanza, it seems to me, where we go from the, actually a cliché, the fur is going to fly, but one that's revisited, one that's given a new lease of life, the fur is going to fly. It's a cliché because it's an accurate description of something that happens in the world of hunting in this case. And we may not know tonight who will finally win the fight. And we can imagine Cash speaking that himself in that extraordinary resonant voice. And we can see that the poem or the ballad there has moved beyond itself and its immediate concerns about a dog catching a raccoon to something larger. But the dogs are in the woods and the hunting's looking good. The fire is burning low. We wet it down and go. And brilliant picture painting again. You yourself referred to the pictures he paints, the painting of a scene. And he's really an adept in that.
Yeah. It's especially later in life, he thought about death and he didn't shrink from it. Here's Forever. Actually, why don't you read it? It will be much better. Forever, which was written in the summer of 2003. And by the way, while you look for that, and by the way, we see his handwritten copy on a line piece of paper also in the book.
There's a sense of being in touch very much with his process and with his method. We're always fascinated by how things get made, no matter what it is, be it a table or a space shuttle or a song. Forever. You tell me that I must perish like the flowers that I cherish, nothing remaining of my name, nothing remembered of my fame. But the trees that I planted still are young. The songs I sang will still be sung, which is a kind of tender and cherishing a word he uses in the piece itself.
Well, and we're thinking of his songs as we hear his poetry, and I just want to listen to one of the later ones, Corinthians 15:15. He starts off pulling from that Bible passage, but then has his own words about death. Let's just listen.
Oh, death, where is thy sting? Oh, grief, where is thy victory? Oh, life, you are a shining path, and hope springs eternal just over the rise when I see my Redeemer beckoning me. Oh, roll my ship over the waves of your sea. Let me find a safe port now and then. Don't let the dark one in your sanctuary until it's time to pack it in.
Oh, row, row my ship with the fire of your breath, and don't lay a broadside on your ship as yet. Blow ye warm winds when it's chilly and wet, and don't come too soon yet for collecting my debt. When you read his poems, you hear more sharply the poetry in his songs. But there's also humor. I love Hey Baby Wake Up. Was this supposed to be a song? Because it could have been.
Yes, Hey Baby, Wake Up, which is amusing and, you know, in a way that, I mean, often we have a feeling that what's amusing really can't possibly be great art. You know, we shouldn't be having fun when we're involved in the literary or artistic process. And, you know, it's so refreshing to read something along the lines of, well, not along the lines of, just something that reads as follows. Hey, baby, wake up. Did you hear the latest news? The man said Roy and Dale split up and Dale got trigger too. Yeah, I hear your sweet feet on the floor. I knew that'd get through to you. Hey, hey, ha, ha, ha. And, yeah, I mean, the immediacy of that is really quite wonderful, and the notion of who gets who when split-ups occur. Yeah. Dale gets triggered.
Paul Muldoon, professor at Princeton University, Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, and editor of Forever Words, The Unknown Poems, poems written by Johnny Cash. You can read them at hereandnow.org. Meantime, Paul, thank you so much.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Well, you wonder why I always dress in black.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
For many cancer patients, chemotherapy and radiation treatment can damage their ability to taste food, sometimes just temporarily, sometimes more permanently. So a neuropsychologist and a couple of celebrity chefs are trying to figure out how to change that, one strange and carefully constructed recipe at a time. Eric Boodman is reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication, and he's got more on this story, and he joins us. Hi there, Eric.
Hey.
So first of all, how common is it for cancer patients to lose their sense of taste during and after treatment?
It's quite common, and it's one of the most commonly reported side effects of radiation and chemotherapy.
I see. And food plays such a central part in their lives, obviously, for health and survival overall. I mean, how do cancer patients, what have they said about the impact that losing this sense of taste has had on them?
I mean, it has a great impact both on their health, but also just their interest in daily activities. So it greatly diminishes their ability to have a social life because how many times do you go out for dinner without eating, for example?
Well, and they also just end up not, I mean, in your story, you talk about how some folks, doctors worry that some folks just, you know, stop eating or severely diminish the amount they eat, which also has a terrible impact on their health. So let's talk about the solutions that that you've reported on, because you recently went to a neurogastronomy symposium at the University of Kentucky. What kind of symposium was this?
So this is this sort of strange amalgam of all of these different fields, including, you know, cooking, but also agriculture and neuroscience and neurology and medicine and history. And all of these different folks are coming together to try to think about what it is that we eat and why and how to make that better in a certain sense.
And the chefs at this symposium were charged with creating dishes specifically for cancer patients and survivors who could no longer taste. What kinds of dishes did they create?
So the two dishes that were created were very, very different. One was created by this amazing synesthetic pastry chef from Atlanta, Taria Camerino, and she used her own very unique way of understanding taste to think about what might cut through some of the bad tastes that are created by chemotherapy and radiation. And so she created this pastry that had a subtle citrus flavor, which she thought would sort of get through that metallic taste that chemo patients often report. And then she wanted to sort of bring the taste, as she says, up into the rest of the head. Mm. And so for that, she used very fragrant things like basil and pistachio.
And
then I guess, oh, go ahead.
Oh, sorry, because we just have a couple, like literally just like 10 seconds left. Did it work?
Not really. In a certain sense, you know, some of it was okay to swallow, but she's still figuring out how this can help other patients.
Yeah, but it's an exciting possibility to think that that there can be treatments that come from the kitchen, I have to say. Eric Boodman is a reporter for our partners at STAT, the health and medicine publication. Eric, thank you so very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
In a statement first released to the Toronto Star and Here and Now this morning, the parents of a Canadian hostage being held in Afghanistan with his American wife and their two little boys born in captivity says it was simply heartbreaking to see them. The video was released this week by the Taliban-linked Haqqani Network, which captured Joshua Boyle and Caitlin Coleman in October 2012. They'd been backpacking around the world and were in Afghanistan. In the video posted online Monday night, Caitlin wears a head covering. She looks pale, but not as thin as she did in previous videos, and she speaks emphatically.
We have waited since 2012 for somebody to understand our problems, the Kafka-esque nightmare in which we find ourselves. We understand both sides hate us and are content to leave us and our two surviving children in these problems.
Her two little children look, well, adorable, one with a pacifier. Her husband Joshua, whose leg chains can be heard clanking as he quiets his sons, bluntly calls his captors arrogant and ignorant. Michelle Shepherd is national security reporter for the Toronto Star. She's become close with the family. She knew Joshua Boyle long before he was taken hostage. We'll get to that. She joins us on Skype. And Michelle, you received the statement, but what more can you tell us about what the parents are saying about seeing their grandchildren for the first time?
Well, as you can imagine, Robin, it's just heartbreaking for them. On one hand, they are delighted to finally see them. It's been, you know, their children have been gone for more than 4 years. And while they knew about their grandsons, they'd never had this type of proof of life video. So on one hand, terrific. And as you said, they're just adorable in this. In the video, they're making faces and the one is sucking on a pacifier. It's really surreal to see them. On the other hand, it's as it's been for them all along, just heartbreaking.
Yeah. Well, Caitlin Coleman's parents in Pennsylvania are not speaking at this time. But we also are hearing about letters that Josh Boyle actually wrote to his parents in Canada talking about how these children were born. He delivered one. She was pregnant surreptitiously.
That's right. There have been writings that the captors have allowed to go both to Josh's family in Canada and Caitlin's family in the U.S. And in one, he says that it seems they kept the pregnancy of the youngest son a secret. And he writes in this letter that he delivered him by flashlight in his mouth. And he writes to his parents, you know, in a quote, sort of, ta-da. And then the boy was there and the captors were surprised.
Yeah.
Again, I keep going back to the words surreal because it is. It's just so hard to imagine any of this.
Yeah. Well, look, Caitlin Coleman was 5 months pregnant when they first began backpacking in Afghanistan. And that raised a lot of questions at the time. And let's get to those because you knew Joshua. He was briefly married to the sister of Omar Khadr, a Canadian who once was held at Guantanamo Bay. So, of course, when Josh and Caitlin were first seized, people assumed that because he had that association with an accused terrorist who was questioned, that Josh himself must have had ties to terrorism. Otherwise, why would they be in Afghanistan with Caitlin pregnant? Talk about what U.S. officials are saying about there being any tie.
Well, the FBI has told the Associated Press, I think the quote was that it was a horrible coincidence, that the two had nothing to do with each other. But that is how I did know Josh before. He had been briefly married to Omar Khadr's sister, and I met him in that way. After they'd been divorced, I kept in touch with Josh because he was just one of these fascinating people, fascinating characters, a real adventurer, and he was really moved by human rights issues. So whenever he was in town, we'd go and have a coffee, just kept in touch by email during his travels. his family didn't know that he was going to go into Afghanistan.
Well, what do you make then, knowing Joshua, of his comments about his captors on this video? Let's listen.
You, like us, probably underestimate the arrogant ignorance that pervades these people and don't understand that we're dealing with the people who think that America killed all the monkeys in their country and the drones are listening to them sleep at night.
Why would he do that, speaking to government officials in the U.S. and being so critical of his captors?
Yeah, I wish I knew. I don't know. That came as a bit of a surprise. The tone was a little different from past videos. There have been other videos with just the couple, not the kids, and they aren't quite so defiant. He's pretty stubborn. He's got very forceful views. So that part doesn't come as a surprise. But it does seem odd that those statements would be allowed out by the captors.
Well, a little more from the family statement. They talk about how Joshua and Caitlin have been getting by with these two little children by play acting the film Life is Beautiful, they write. That's the film about the man who had to protect his son from knowing that he was in a concentration camp. I mean, we're learning how they're doing this, but it still seems impossible.
Doesn't it? I know. And again, looking at that video from yesterday, like you, I watched it quite a few times, and you see the elder boy laughing, and it's almost as if somebody maybe off camera is making faces at him, or he's looking at his reflection. It's not really clear, but you know, then he does what every little four-year-old does, and he starts picking his nose during this hostage video. It's really hard to fathom. It does seem almost like a movie, although I'm not even sure you'd do a movie about this because no one would believe it.
Right.
It's incredible.
And in this most recent video, Caitlin Coleman speaks directly to President Obama and President-elect Donald Trump.
Obama, your legacy on leaving office is probably important to you, and our lives and these of our children are to us. So please don't become the next Jimmy Carter. Just give the offenders something so they and you can save face. And we can leave the region permanently. Donald Trump, the legacy of a millennia of demon worship in this country is that those who speak high and noble of Islamic ideals are not going to simply release our family easily because it is correct. They want money, power, friends. You must give them these things before progress can be made.
Of course, we hear the little baby there. Now, Caitlin was referring to President Carter, who was unable to release the Iranian hostages till after his presidency. He worked doggedly at that, but wasn't able to do it until, you know, Reagan was being inaugurated. That sounded as if that was scripted for them.
It might have been. I mean, it's similar to what some of the past videos have said. I think the emphasis of that, and I think Josh's parents also raised this in their statement, is that this is a direct plea to governments. So these pleas don't go to the families. And other cases, other hostage-taking cases, there's a ransom that's demanded or other demands. But it's clear that they're looking for the Haqqani network, who we believe is holding them, is looking for some sort of trade, some sort of government deal.
Well, there were negotiations to free them as part of the deal that freed U.S. soldier Bo Bergdahl. Those failed. But meantime, is there a sense that there's more urgency now? We know that Anas Haqqani, the son of the Haqqani network founder, has been sentenced to death in Kabul. Is there a sense that there's some more urgency for Joshua and Caitlin now because of that sentencing?
It feels that way. The last video that was released in August coincided with a court settlement that sentenced Anas Haqqani to death. And in that video, they indicated that they needed the Afghan government to not put him to death. They needed some sort of deal there. So I think that is definitely part of the timeline. And I think also politically in the U.S. with the presidential power changing, I think there's some urgency there.
Yeah. But by and large, most Americans seem to not be aware of this story. I mean, this was a big deal when this video came out Monday morning. You saw it all over morning television, but then it seemed to disappear. There was a fascination with seeing two children. But do you ever wonder, why isn't there more uproar over this?
I do. I think it's the same in Canada, though. You'd have the same experience here. There's a certain callousness about their plight. And a lot of people feel, I shouldn't say a lot of people, but I've definitely heard from those who say, you know, they were naive, I don't really care, maybe they're getting what they deserved, which is really a terrible way to look at this.
Getting what they deserve for what they did, which was naively going backpacking in Afghanistan, 5 months pregnant. Michelle Shepherd, National Security Reporter for the Toronto Star, thank you.
Thanks for having me, Robin.
Good morning, Jarvis.
Good morning, Mark. It's Saturday, so you only have 5 meetings. Room temperature is set to a cool 68 degrees.
Well, the first voice you heard there was Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg. He's addressing Jarvis, Zuckerberg's new voice interactive AI home assistant. And if Jarvis himself sounds familiar, that's because it's the voice of actor Morgan Freeman. Zuckerberg's video, posted on his Facebook page, of course, shows how Jarvis can control the lights in addition to the thermostat at Zuckerberg's home. Jarvis even makes toast, but doesn't seem to be able to butter it. Now, Zuckerberg programmed the Jarvis AI assistant himself, but asked the public for voice suggestions, and Morgan Freeman got the nod. Well, in February of 1980, a teenager from Salt Lake City discovered a secret room. Its architect was easy to identify because his name was written vertically down a computer screen, Warren Robinette. Robinette was the man behind the secret room whose hidden message was buried in a popular Atari video game called Adventure. Atari was completely unaware of it until the 15-year-old teen wrote a letter describing what he'd found. Tim Skog of Here and Now contributor WBUR has this profile of Robinette, computer programmer, game designer, and creator of one of the earliest known secret rooms, or Easter eggs, tucked away in a video game.
When I found that I was designing video games for a company that was controlled by people that were going to force me to be an anonymous contributor, even though I created the entire game, Adventure, it made me mad. It was a power play, and after a while of being frustrated, not enjoying being under the heel of the big money guys, I had a sneaky idea, which was to hide my name in the game. I was making the graphics, I was writing the code, I was making the sound effects, so I was in control of everything. So if I wanted to make a really hard-to-get-to place in the video game, a secret room, and then put my name in there, well, that would be a way to outfox the power guys who were running Atari then. Where I got that idea was somebody played one of the Beatles songs backwards and they thought they could hear it say, "I buried Paul." And so that was my model for hiding my name in the video game. A secret message hidden in a hard to find place. And of course the message was important to me. Just like an artist puts his signature down in the corner of a painting, same thing. Well, I wanted to make it hard to get into the secret room because I didn't want somebody who was testing it beforehand to find this, so I did not make it easy. And I thought I might have made it too hard. I wasn't sure any kid would actually find it, so it was a little bit of a experiment. Here's what had to happen for you to get into the secret room. If you went and got the bridge, people who had played the game knew that you could use the bridge to cross walls and crossed into this little chamber and then moved around a little bit, you'd hear doo-doo-doo, that picking up sound, doo-doo-doo, and the dropping sound, doo-doo-doo-doo. They were the same notes but in opposite order. And then if you looked down there, you could see that you'd picked up a tiny little object. It was 1 pixel in size. The guy who wrote the manual didn't know about the secret room or the dots, so it didn't say anything about a dot or a secret room in the game's manual. So, story I've heard from some players over the years is that the kids would go crazy. They wouldn't let their parents turn off the TV or the video game for weeks while they explored the entire game world, trying this and trying that. They knew the dot had to do something, but they didn't know what. And the answer was that there was a certain wall that if you brought the dot into that room and you had another object or two in there, that side wall would disappear. And that suggested that you could go through it. And in fact, you could go through it. And once you did that, you got into the secret room. And then why hold back? At that point, My name filled the screen, flashing colored lights, created by Warren Robinette. I went from feeling downtrodden and under heel to feeling like I was winning this battle. This is kind of a David and Goliath story, I think, because I was definitely the little guy in this fight. And I handed the game in to be manufactured. I quit my job because I was being treated as a bad employee. I mean, I invented the action-adventure game, sold a million units, and made $25 million for Atari. But Atari did not know about the secret room until a 15-year-old kid from Salt Lake City wrote them a letter and explained in detail with maps how to get into the secret room. I quit Atari, the game was released, Atari found out about the Easter egg, so other programmers at Atari who were making games found out about it. They wanted to hear about the Easter egg in the secret room, so one night we had pizza and beer. I told them how I did it, how I implemented it, about keeping it secret. And as I looked around the table, there were about six or eight Atari game designers there. I could see a gleam in every eye, like they were already thinking about how they were going to put their secret message into their Atari 2600 game.
Our story was produced by Tim Skoge.